This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a glimmer of hope for some modest reform in the mass Black incarceration regime. Mumia Abu-Jamal explains why white supremacy actually means white male supremacy. New York City activists take the fight against police repression underground into the subways. And why do so many liberals and even some supposed leftists seem to be in love with the FBI?
But first, the United States has backed regime change in Venezuela for most of this century, but now Washington appears to be escalating hostilities, threatening military action against the socialist-led country. Ajamu Baraka is lead organizer of the Black Alliance for Peace.
We are very concerned about what we see as some very troubling signs regarding Venezuela. It appears that the rhetoric of regime change that we hear coming from the current administration might, in fact, reflect a real strategy. We have heard that there are military units from the Colombian state and even the state of Brazil up on the borders of Venezuela. We know that the talks that were taking place between the government and the so-called opposition broke down because the opposition at the very last moment decided that they were not going to sign the agreement that everybody thought had been brokered and was in place. So it appears that the U.S. state has opted for some type of intervention. Secretary of State Tillerson openly called for some type of military intervention that was also followed by comments from Senator Mark Rubio. So the thinking is that because they see the danger of Maduro winning the presidential vote, that would then ensure that he would remain in power for the next 6 years, that the window of opportunity for an anti-democratic intervention is slowly closing.
Well, the United States has been threatening Venezuela one way or the other, at least since 2002, when the U.S. backed an attempted coup. Why do you think that the siren levels should get louder right now?
Because the state has been sufficiently weakened. The sanctions have resulted in real pain on the part of the people in Venezuela. And this administration is even more aggressive in its interventionist strategies than even the Obama administration. And we all know and remember that the Obama administration declared that Venezuela was a threat to U.S. national security. And the last factor, again, is that they saw what happened in the races for governor in Venezuela back in October, where they thought that as a consequence of the destabilization process, that the people had sufficiently turned against the government and against the party. But the party won 18 of the 23 governorships that were up for election. And they feel that the same kind of results, that is a popular affirmation of the Bolivarian process by electing the current president, Maduro, they believe that that would then undermine their attempts to try to delegitimize the government and suggest that there's no real popular support for the government. So this is the moment. They don't want to see, and in my opinion, they really don't want to see the election that's scheduled for April 22nd to take place. So now is the time to intervene. And that is, I think, also the analysis coming from many people inside the country.
You seem to be describing an imperial state in a state of deep frustration.
Frustration, of course, because there's still a process, a popular process in Venezuela. People are still supporting the integrity of their state. People still are committed to sovereignty and seeing Venezuela stand up as a sovereign state, even if they have issues with the government. There are people inside of Venezuela that believe in the principle of self-determination. And so there is this national question, this national issue, and that they are prepared to defend their state, their process, their nation against these external interventions. Now, it's framed as an understanding that the interventions are external, even though the U.S. government attempts to prop up this so-called opposition. But that opposition has been discredited. It had very little credibility from the very beginning because we're talking about a despotic oligarchy. But that opposition has even more problems in terms of trying to present itself as a legitimate opposition as a consequence of the kinds of activities and actions that their supporters were involved in over the last couple of years, and especially the kind of violence that had a racial character to it. The burning people alive, that is primarily people of color, darker skin, black people, who they assumed that if they were dark skinned and poor, they had to be supporters of the government. And these individuals ended up losing their lives in the most gruesome manner. So the violence that they initiated and sustained for quite some time had the effect of turning significant segments of the population against the opposition. So people perceive correctly, I believe, that what's driving the continued tensions inside the country, violence inside the country, is in fact the influences from outside the country, primarily coming from the U.S. As I said a moment ago, there have been negotiations between the opposition and the government, and everyone thought that there was a deal that was brokered by the former prime minister of Spain and the Dominican Republic. But at the very last moment, we believe that Rex Tillerson ordered the opposition to pull out, and that signed the agreement. So this is perceived as an externally driven process there in Venezuela.
And you mentioned the racial character of much of the opposition's violence. And anyone who's observed the situation in Venezuela can see the racial nature of the conflict, of the relationship of forces there. But the Venezuelan government doesn't call attention to that aspect.
Well, to their detriment, in the sense that the situation, in fact, has been racialized. I mean, the connection between class and race is quite clear in Venezuela. And I think that if those connections are made and made even clearer, then there will be even more solidarity that could be generated as a consequence of that. So they think some elements of the government and even of the party, they have not chosen to sharpen that line of analysis for, I guess, various reasons. But for us who are observing this process, those lines are quite clear and very troubling.
You, of course, that is the Black Alliance for Peace, have always put the threat to Venezuela up front. But have you seen difficulties in getting others in the anti-war movement to give priority to the threat to Venezuela?
Well, you know, there are elements of the anti-war movement and the anti-imperialist movement that's quite clear about where we should stand on this question of U.S. intervention. People are taking positions that say that even if you have certain issues with the political process inside that country, again, when there is a situation emerging where a nation finds itself in the crosshairs of U.S. imperialism, our responsibility as citizens of empire is to attempt to try to put a break on the empire, put a break on the interventionist proclivities of this state. So they have been quite responsive, as a matter of fact. The issue we've had, though, is not with the part of the left that will define itself as anti-imperialist, or mainly anti-war, but that part of the left that claims to be anti-imperialist, or just part of the left or the radical left, if you will. Those elements have been somewhat reluctant to give full support to the efforts to try to block intervention. They have been less than enthusiastic about being clear about any opposition to a U.S. intervention. And as a consequence, the ability to generate solidarity, revolutionary solidarity, if you will, in the U.S. and in Western Europe has been problematic. In fact, we see that he's even more contradictory in Western Europe than in the U.S. Just recently, for example, the only democratic element of the EU, the European Parliament, just awarded their Sakharov Human Rights Prize to the opposition in Venezuela. The same opposition that we just talked about have been burning people alive, engaging in all kinds of violent activity against the Venezuela state, an opposition that everybody recognizes, at least in Latin America and many other parts of the world, is an opposition that is grounded in the oligarchy. And we know the character of the oligarchies in Latin America. These are some very vicious elements. But yet, these individuals are the ones that the European Parliament decides that they're going to honor. So this is, again, another reflection of the confusion, and not even confusion, the collaboration we see over and over again, it appears, between those forces that claim to be left or radical and their imperialist states. So, yeah, we've been having some very significant problems generating a unified oppositional character or front to the real possibility of U.S. more direct intervention into Venezuela.
Yes, for example, Bernie Sanders, who lots of people consider to be a leftist, referred to the late leader of Venezuela, Chavez, as a dictator, even though Chavez was repeatedly elected in free and fair ballots.
And we know that for the consciousness of people in the U.S., no matter if they claim to be progressive, and Bernie Sanders claims to be a progressive, anytime you stand in opposition to the interests of the American ruling class, it doesn't really matter whether or not you engage in any kind of process that can be defined as democratic, you become a dictator. In fact, they extract you from that revolutionary process and they create this individual who's supposed to stand above the process, who is so individualistic and inclined to corruption and brutality that the only reason there is a process is because of the personality of that person and that person's grip on the state. It's a very simplistic narrative, but it's a kind of simplistic narrative that unfortunately still plays in this country and apparently in Western Europe. That's what they've done with Muammar Gaddafi, even though we know that Muammar Gaddafi was the leader of the revolution in Libya. He became a dictator in the narrative that was projected by the West and the U.S. So this is part of their ideological ammunition they use to rationalize their white savior complex in order to generate support in the U.S., that the U.S. has to intervene in order to save those victims of these vicious dictators. And then when you remind them that there are, in fact, democratic processes in those states, then they just claim that those processes are not, in fact, democratic and just don't count.
Similarly, it's not hard to find people who call themselves progressive and lots of folks in the Democratic Party who will call for the United States to shut down its prison in Guantanamo. But the Black Alliance for Peace is calling for the United States to withdraw totally from Guantanamo, which is a part of Cuba, which Cuba wants back.
Exactly. In fact, we are gearing up to bring attention to the fact that on February 23rd, we will be commemorating the 115th year anniversary of the seizure of Guantanamo by the U.S. And so, yes, we are calling for the base to be closed, and we are generating actions to bring attention to the continuation of Guantanamo, reminding people that even though the Obama administration claimed that they wanted to close Guantanamo, it never got closed. And now even that pretext has been reversed by the Trump administration that has now said that they're going to keep that base open indefinitely. We are saying, yes, close Guantanamo, but we are going further. We are saying close Guantanamo, withdraw from that territory that does not belong to you and turn that land back over to its rightful owner, the Cuban government. So, yes, we want to educate people on Guantanamo. But we also want to do this, Glenn. We also want to begin to call attention to the fact that Cuba is, in fact, in the Caribbean. It's part of the Caribbean. And that we tend to think about militarism. We can think about South America. We sometimes even think about Central America. But we don't think about the Caribbean. And Cuba is both part of the sort of Latin America experience, but also Cuba is in the Caribbean. So we want to begin to talk about U.S. militarism in the Caribbean basin.
Yes, we must remind people that the lease on Guantanamo was negotiated when the U.S. was occupying Cuba with troops, negotiation at the point of a gun.
Exactly. That's why it really has no real force of law and political morality. That basically, with the change in the government in Cuba, a government that's now more representative of the interests of the people, all of those agreements that was made up to that point are now, in many people's estimation, null and void. So the issue of legality is something that the U.S. will raise, but it is a point that reasonable people and people who are guided by a sense of fairness and morality would tend to reject. That basically, what right does this government have, the U.S. government, what right does it have to occupy the territory of another state besides brute force?
That was Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace. Baraka is also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report.
The Senate Judiciary Committee easily passed a bill to give judges more latitude in sentencing, bypassing some mandatory minimum guidelines and providing a way out of prison for some of those convicted under the old racist 100-to-1 crack cocaine laws. The Washington-based Sentencing Project works constantly for criminal justice system reform. Kara Ghosh, the Sentencing Project's Director of Strategic Initiatives, says the Senate committee action is a very big deal.
It is a really big deal. We have a Republican Congress, Republican-run Senate Judiciary Committee with Chairman Grassley, and it's encouraging that despite what Attorney General Sessions, his rhetoric on ramping up the drug war and his policy changes at the Department of Justice that has really prioritized increasing enforcement and sentencing for drug crimes, that a bipartisan Senate Judiciary Committee had chose to move forward on really significant reforms for drug sentences. And that's a really good thing.
Most judges would like the kind of flexibility that this legislation partially provides.
Absolutely. I know that the U.S. Sentencing Commission has, over the years, has conducted surveys of federal judges on their perspectives on various issues, including sentencing for drug cases. And high majorities of federal judges have said that they do not like the mandatory minimums, I think, for drug offenses and think that they are excessive.
You say that about 3,100 people who might benefit directly from this are those who are still in prison because of the old 100-to-1 crack cocaine law.
That's right. So in 2010, Congress passed the Fair Sentencing Act, which reformed the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine. So now it's a 18-to-1. But it's been almost 8 years now, and 8 years later, there are still thousands of people in prison under the outdated, now reformed law. And we feel very strongly, and what this bill would do is provide an opportunity for those people currently in prison to petition for a sentence reduction under the new law.
It should be noted that the Obama administration argued in federal court that people such as these 3,100, I believe there were about 5,000 or 6,000 at the time, should not be released based upon previous legislation.
Yeah, well, that's right. There was some evolving in the first few years after passage of the Fair Sentencing Act. So initially, there were cases they called pipeline cases. So initially, the Department of Justice under Attorney General Holder's position was only if your offense was committed after signing of the bill, which would have been in August of 2010, could the new law apply to you. And so there were a number of cases of people who hadn't yet been sentenced after passage of the Fair Sentencing Act, but their offense was actually committed prior to its passage. And so for at least a year, the Department of Justice argued that even those people who hadn't yet been sentenced should be sentenced under the old law because their crime was committed before passage of the law. Eventually, after lots of litigation, the Department of Justice changed its mind and allowed what we call the pipeline cases, cases that hadn't yet made it through the system, even if their crime is committed before 2018, to be, if they hadn't yet been sentenced, that they be allowed to be sentenced under the new law. However, it didn't help some people, and people who were sentenced before passage of the law were out of luck, so the new law didn't benefit them.
Yes, I think it's important to note this so that this bill is not characterized as simply going up against the wishes of the Trump administration, but also the wishes, as expressed in practice, of the Obama administration regarding those who were sentenced before 2010.
That's right.
You note that Trump's budget is calling for a 5% increase in the federal prison population, which has been marginally decreasing. He's looking forward to putting more people in jail.
Well, certainly that's what the budget is projecting. They're projecting a significant increase over the next year in the federal prison population. We don't know how that will play out, but certainly given moves by the Attorney General to increase sentencing and charging for drug crimes, for immigration offenses, they expect, and I expect, for those numbers to go up. And so they're seeking more funding. Interestingly enough, while they anticipate the population going up, they do also plan to cut to slash jobs. There already is an overcrowding crisis within the federal prison system, less so at the lower security prisons, but at higher and medium security facilities, there continues to be an overcrowding problem. Staff who are not trained to be correctional officers, but are medical professionals, administrative jobs, are routinely being taken out of their normal positions and being asked to perform correctional officer duties because the prisons can't function in a safe way. And so they're moving people around in positions they weren't necessarily hired to do. And that's very troubling. And so to make additional cuts is very concerning for anyone who cares about safety and conditions in federal prisons.
Seems irrational for a budget to be cut when the budget makers are projecting a 5% increase in the number of people that have to be handled.
It certainly is. It certainly is irrational.
This bill has passed the Senate Judiciary Committee, and that's a milestone, but it's got a full Senate and a House in front of it.
That's right. And now it's a really important time for folks to be weighing in with their senators and their representatives in the House to say that they support sentencing reform and criminal justice reform and want to see a vote. Majority Leader McConnell had an opportunity to bring this bill to the floor last Congress when President Obama was in the White House, and he did not. And so we need to increase the pressure on him and our representatives and make sure that they know criminal justice reform is a priority for the American public.
Certainly, Attorney General Sessions would think this bill is a direct affront to him. Could you envision a Republican House of Representatives siding with this bill over their Attorney General?
It's hard to know. Last Congress, you know, the House of Representatives, their Judiciary Committee also passed sentence reform legislation that was very similar to what passed yesterday in the Senate. Speaker Paul Ryan has been a supporter of criminal justice reform, including sentencing reform, for a number of years now. I honestly think that the viewpoint of the Attorney General, his viewpoint is marginalized because it is not sort of where the consensus is, the bipartisan consensus is on criminal justice. I just hope that lawmakers aren't going to be persuaded by his sort of backwards rhetoric and uninformed policy choices. I mean, he's not looking at the research that says how we know to prevent crime, to discourage people from using drugs. He's not using that data. He is relying on decades-old drug war tactics to try and address his concerns and everyone's concerns about the growing opioid epidemic. But if anything is clear, it's that despite very harsh federal sentencing policies for drugs, people are still using drugs and using them in increasing levels. So we should know, take that to heart, that tough sentences isn't the way to address our drug problems. It's investing in prevention, health care, and diversion programs. That's going to help us move in a better direction.
And we should add, we're talking about lots of white people using drugs.
Certainly there has been a significant increase in white people using in the opioid crisis, lots of people dying from overdoses from opioids, both prescription drugs and from heroin and fentanyl. But it's affecting all communities, not just the white community, but communities of color, the African-American community, Hispanic communities. So it's something everyone should be concerned about.
Kara Ghosh of the Sentencing Project, speaking from Washington.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, has long been broadcast in essays and commentaries for prison radio. He explains why white supremacy actually means white male supremacy.
When Donald Trump lamented at the loss of one of his employees' career, a bomb of female protest erupted, for he, not surprisingly, ignored the suffering of his employees' ex-wives. The only real surprise here was why the surprise? After the Roy Moore debacle of a U.S. Senate candidate's Lolita complex, as in a hankering for young girls, who can dare plead surprise? Only someone who hasn't really been looking can feign surprise. Trump's central program is to somehow return America to the 1950s, when Negroes were quiet, women were submissive, and Hispanics knew their place, like Mexico, Puerto Rico. This fever dream, a back to the future reality show, is the focus of Trump world. To do this, you have to ignore history to build a new history in imitation of the supposed old days. Yes, it's crazy, but it ain't the only time the U.S. went crazy. Consider the war mania that resulted from 9/11. War on anybody to quell the beating heart drunk with fear. Iraq, check. Afghanistan, double check. War to salve the worried American soul. In Trump world, blacks don't count. Hispanics don't count. Arabs don't count. Women don't count either. Yes, even white women. It's time for the good old boy.
That was political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Shannon Jones is a veteran organizer with Bronxites for NYPD Accountability. She and her comrades spend lots of time underground in the New York subway system, fighting police racism and repression. Jones explained to Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier what the Swipe It Forward campaign is all about.
For those that don't know, Swipe It Forward is in sustained indignation to broken windows policing and predatory tactics by the NYPD and the MTA subway system. So we definitely work towards having Swipe It Forward actions with some level of frequency. So most recently was January 17th and February 7th. The 17th action was at 149th Street and 3rd Avenue, the 2 and 5 line. And the February 7th action was at 125th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue, the A, B, C, and D line. The 117 action was put on by my organization, Bronxites for NYPD Accountability, also known as Y Accountability. So we were able to finance that event. And we had roughly seven or eight people working with us to make the action go very, very well. And we were very, very fortunate to have a young vanguard turn out for the first time, Mr. Jeffrey Almonte. He is very well regarded in the video and art youth community in the Bronx. So it was great for him to link up with us and participate and get a feel of it. So I believe we spent roughly about $250 for about 45 minutes of free swipes.
And so these two recent Swipe It Forward events, one was in the Bronx, the other in Harlem. As a veteran of the Swipe It Forward actions, have you noticed any borough distinctions as regards people's levels of participation, slave catcher resistance or difficulties, the reception of the MTA workers, or has it been more or less similar across boroughs?
Well, as we've done this action numerous times at the five boroughs, because we've even done Staten Island, people are becoming more and more familiar. So it's folks that are in need that are familiar, MTA workers and the police are familiar with this action. So now into 2018, what I'm noticing is, you know, the NYPD definitely hangs back because they know that we know it's legal. So their derailing tactics that they would use in 2016 and 2017, they certainly don't do. At 125th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue, there is a transit office inside of the train station. But for 2018 action, no police officers came out. In 2016 and 2017, sometimes we would have opposition actually from MTA workers that would be confused or engage in derailing tactics in some sort of hollow solidarity with the NYPD, which is actually ridiculous considering the NYPD, you know, bears some responsibility for the death of the token booth clerk that they arrested from accusing him of failing to bust the gate to let them in. So what I would see in the past as problematic has waned a little bit. In terms of the folks that could use a swipe, 149th and 3rd Avenue is the South Bronx. It's a very, very, very high-need community. So we went through our budget for the action really, really quickly at 125th Street and St. Nicholas Avenue because that area is gentrifying at a fever pitch. You see a mixed group of subway riders, and there are folks that do need the swipe, but then there are a lot of folks that actually don't, but because they're familiar with Swipe It Forward, they may swipe someone in on their way out in solidarity, donate money on the spot. So, you know, we're really changing the culture of behavior around swiping folks in. I think most people at this point understand that it's legal to swipe someone in on your way out with an unlimited Metro card. If you have a paper ride, you can swipe in whoever the hell you want. And the police should basically stay out of that interaction between folks in need and those that are willing and able to assist. And I always say that Swipe It Forward is black self-defense. It's not like, you know, in the 80s where you threw an extra quarter in the net for the person at the toll behind you. It's not like that. The primary purpose is sustained indignation, the broken windows policing, and predatory tactics in the transit system. And in order to keep our own people safe from the clutches of the NYPD, we are helping each other. It is a self-defense action. So I can't stress that enough.
So as you pointed out, Swipe It Forward is making inroads in the popular consciousness. With that said, what do you think is the next step forward for Swipe It Forward? What would you see as a concrete victory given the fact that Swipe It Forward has made real ground as regards people opening up to the need to swipe their fellow New Yorkers into the train station?
Well, the ultimate victory for Swipe It Forward organizers and the entire black and brown city of New York is free transportation for everybody, because that eliminates the hierarchical structure, that eliminates the racism, that eliminates the rabid NYPD coming after us, that eliminates the imbalance. Everybody rides for free. You know, in other municipalities, you have to pay for your garbage to get picked up. We don't pay for our garbage to get picked up. We shouldn't have to pay to commute. There are people in this city that are viciously, viciously rent burdened, that work every day, paying 50 and 60 and even instances 70% of their income in rent. But then we have this expectation that they're supposed to be able to afford $100 or $150 in transportation for themselves and maybe a teenage child or student that does not get a Metro card or needs to be moving throughout the city after 8 p.m. on school nights or on weekends. It's a financial burden. And for those that say, well, you need the money to make it run, hey, last time I checked, my garbage gets picked up for free. These are municipal services that the city can very easily provide for free, and that will definitely level the playing field on who's able to enter the system, to travel around, to handle their business, seize opportunities, and et cetera. So that would be the ultimate victory. In the interim, a victory for Swipe It Forward organizers would be a drastic, drastic reduction in the number of arrests of black and brown people in the subway system for fare being, and a drastic, drastic reduction in summonses issued for fare beating against black and brown people in the city of New York, because we are protecting one another.
That's exactly where I was going to go with this. I mean, you mentioned them needing these funds to maintain the subway system, but of course, as we know, these so-called theft of services arrests comprise in the top two consistently of arrests throughout the city for the NYPD. So given that economic reality, have you noticed other tactics on the part of these slave catchers inside the subway system or throughout the MTA to make sure that they keep this revenue stream going?
Exactly. Folks continue to be arrested every single day for fare beating, every single day. Legal aid, public defender organizations continue to report on a daily basis defendants in the criminal justice system for fare beating, despite what any district attorney may say or what politicians want to say. Fare beating remains criminalized, and folks are being sucked into Rikers on the $1,000 bail, $500 bail if they can't pay. If I have $275, I have $1,000, so I'm basically going to Rikers. However, when folks choose to swipe this forward and do it overtly, what that does is intercept that quota system. It intercepts that arrest for that moment. That's why it's very, very critical that as many of us do it as much as possible. However, someone else may get arrested right after I've swiped someone in and they've entered the system. So this is like a back-to-back thing that we really have to engage in, because the police are still doing that thing. They're still doing that. You know, that hasn't stopped. Now, they may conduct themselves differently when we perform the resistance action of Swipe It Forward itself in the subway, but they're definitely still arresting people. No doubt about it.
We know that with this Black Panther film dropping, there's been a lot of renewed and in some ways new discussions around the Black Panther Party. And it sounds to me as though you're saying that Swipe It Forward represents a kind of survival program.
Absolutely. Serve the People program. Definitely it's a Serve the People program. But again, I always try to make sure I put up front that this is self-defense against the rabid NYPD, because since we've been doing Swipe It Forward nearly almost 2 years, we've been faced with a lot of co-optation from either nonprofit groups, other organizations, or even individuals, Europeans coming along and trying to transform Swipe It Forward into some sort of altruism or some type of charity work, which it is not in any way. We really try to put that up front. Assisting your brother and sister in the train station definitely feels good. I can't take that away from anyone. But this is in sustained indignation to the racist NYPD that is overfunded, over-resourced, and they're just rabid. That's the only word I can really use right now to describe it. They are rabid.
Well, speaking of the rabid NYPD and these slave catchers writ large, we know that Why Accountability stays up on their rabid ways. And so outside of these recent Swipe It Forward actions, are there any other developments as regards the NYPD or law enforcement nationally that y'all have in your sights at present?
In New York City, we have a black female cop convicted just this week of falsifying paperwork to steal a man's home. She signed a deed, forged the guy's signature, and got one of her homies as a notary to notarize it. And then they filed it with the municipal building. Fraud. Fraud. NYPD. Then most importantly, Sergeant Hugh Barry was found not guilty in the shooting murder of Deborah Dana, which was highly, highly disturbing. His accounts conflicted from the beginning. She held the bat, swung the bat, was going to swing the bat, could have swung it, might have swung it. EMT says, I didn't see her swing it. So it was conflicting reports, conflicting narratives, changing narratives. He chose a bench trial as opposed to jury trial and was acquitted. The police officers that supported him wore We Are Barry shirts, which is problematic. And also just to give some critique on us as a movement and as black people, we were not present in physicality for Deborah Dana in court with that trial for Hugh Barry. Very few people showed up, which left those folks are subject to intimidation tactics by court officers and the police department. So we also have to do better. My organization, Why Accountability, were present for Timothy Kaufman hearings, the trial of our mentor Jeffries, former NYC, shut it down, the Grand Central Group, Black Lives Matter organizer. She was convicted of jaywalking, which is really significant because she is the first person to be prosecuted by the NYPD under the Memorandum of Understanding signed off by the police department and the district attorney, Cy Vance, which is actually landmark. And I'm pressed to understand why people didn't really latch on and tune into that and be present in physicality for that, because that's setting a precedent that the NYPD not only will arrest you, but then they'll also be prosecutor. And if anybody has gone to any, even a Eurocentric public school, you know that there's different branches of government. So that defies common sense. So she was convicted in that kangaroo court. We were present for that. We were present for a Kai Gurley trial back in 2016. So for Deborah Dana, it also comes down to resources. And it's funny that you mentioned the Black Panther movie, because let me tell you, I'll be honest, and I won't give away any spoilers, but what I will say is people should be able to enjoy themselves and have a great time. However, I want to see black people keep that same energy when it comes to these racist police, because it's not fun and games all the time. And folks brought out their African garb. They brought out their war paint. They made crowdfunding pages in order to pay for folks that were not financially able to see this movie, But during the Deborah Dana trial, the past 9 days, there were barely 5 people there on behalf of Deborah Dana and our family. So, you know, we got to do better.
Is there anything else that you would like to leave us with?
Well, what I will tell people is that they can always get in contact with Bronx Heights or NYPD Accountability. We're across all social media. Our email is info@yaccountability.com, 646-856-9847. We also have a crowdfund, that's GoFundMe.com/yaccountability. We are looking to have a Swipe It Forward town hall coming really, 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 really soon so we can continue to speak out against predatory policing in the transit system. And if folks want to get involved, my advice is this. Pick your passion and be very, very clear about what it is that you want to liberate yourself from. Be uncompromising. Always have collective dignity and self-pride in all of your efforts and understand that you're doing it for the collective. And don't let any people that really don't have collective black power interests in mind run your operation or tell you, you know, what it is to do. I always tell people, start a cop watch group. And most importantly, reach out to the people directly where you live. Because as much, you know, quote-unquote activating that we like to do, the first people on your side are your friends, neighbors, and family. That's always a great place to start.
That was Shannon Jones of Bronxites for NYPD Accountability, speaking with Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier.
Ever since Hillary Clinton's campaign blamed her defeat on the Russians, folks that claim to be people of the left have been having a love affair with the FBI and the CIA. Professor Ward Churchill has some ideas on how that happened. Churchill is co-author of the book, Agents of Repression, a study of the FBI's campaign to destroy black and left organizations. He was interviewed by veteran broadcaster Don DeBar, Community Public Radio News.
Looking at the spectacle of all of these people that have identified as progressives, that, you know, call themselves of the left, certainly that are described as lefties by the media, Fox particularly, but even MSNBC and CNN, that we're supposed to believe the FBI and the CIA with respect to Trump, Russia, God knows what else, and that people that speak against it are somehow, there's a variety of things. You're involved in a red-brown coalition with fascists in Russia and a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, you could give us a little history and a little context for all of this.
Well, I guess you could look to the 1950s for similar absurdities when the liberal left bailed, condemning people who were actual radicals across the board. It's not a perfect parallel, but it's kind of revealing in a way that suddenly the FBI becomes a champion in internal fights in the eyes of self-styled progressives or lefties or whatever they think they are, the opposition to the Republican status quo, whatever that might be at time. But it's a way of affirming, essentially, that status quo in which both sides are participants. So the idea that the House left, if you will, would embrace the FBI when it's a matter of convenience for them to make a point is unsurprising in the long sweep of things, although I think it comes as something of a shock to people who actually have politics and are not aware of the overall history, would find surprising. It should not come as a surprise. If you know your history, then it becomes obvious what's going on in a way. Understand that the same people who are cast as the left opposition in this framework have the liberals, if you will, although that's a term that really has kind of lost its meaning.
Right, like all of them, really.
Richard Nixon was more liberal than a lot of the people purporting to that title.
For sure. Yep.
At this point, all right?
Yep.
So we have this slippage in the meaning of terms, but the great sin of the FBI in most people's mind, insofar as they're aware of it, was the COINTELPRO operations that began in the 1950s and were formally terminated in 1971, but which have continued apace. We can get into that if you like. I mean, there actually are political operations going on. But the COINTELPRO stuff, which was attributed to J. Edgar Hoover, which commenced under Republican administration, the Eisenhower administration, in the 1950s, was supposedly continued without the knowledge of the succeeding Democratic administrations. In fact, they were informed. They were told as much as they wanted to know.
Right.
They want plausible deniability in all, whether it's Kennedy or Johnson or the various attorney generals, including Ramsey Clark, I'm sad to say, basically signed off on them. So it served their interest to have actual radical or dissident opposition stifled in silence. And there are political things going on, repressive things, COINTELPRO, if you will. Current example, the real deal. Not the stuff that's contrived about who's doing what to whom inside the institutional box, but the thing that's going on with Black Lives Matter and other organizations being lumped together under the heading of Black Identity Extremists.
Right.
That's okay, right. Which is kind of like Black Nationalist Hate Groups. That was the caption that was used during COINTELPRO itself, secretly,
Okay,
until that stuff was disclosed in the 1970s. That was their, in their cryptonymic operation that was being carried out, COINTELPRO itself. All right.
Yeah.
Well, you've got a guy now who's facing 10 years in Dallas for speech activities, captioned a Black Identity Extremist because he is prominent in the Huey P. Newton Gun Club, which is simply a Black organization drawing on a history of Second Amendment claims by so-called Black nationalist hate group, Black Panther Party, named for the head of the Black Panther Party, came up with the police thing, availing themselves of legal rights to carry unconcealed weapons in California.
The
law got changed as a result of their availing themselves of their rights. He's drawing on that tradition. In the Black community, and part of Black Lives Matter, too, as far as I can tell, he's facing 10 years simply for possession of two perfectly legal weapons. He is convicted, he pled guilty, to a misdemeanor domestic violence dispute in Tennessee, which makes it illegal, since it was domestic violence, for him to be in possession, although he's not a convicted felon, of a weapon. He didn't even know it. And they know he didn't know it, but evidence being used to deny him bond and prosecute him on these really serious charges. Evidence impounded was a copy of Robert F. Williams' Negroes with Guns. You're talking a book that was first published circa 1960, two generations in the past, mere possession of the book.
Yeah.
And his speech activities are being invoked. That's it. He's got associations with groups advocating the rights of Blacks, like just like the right-wingers in this country, to bear arms and defend themselves against armed attack. I mean, that's a position indistinguishable in a lot of ways from the National Rifle Association.
With the exception of a long history of Black people actually being murdered that the people in the NRA haven't experienced. They've only read about.
Well, it's the FBI which is running the show in this.
Right. This is a bipartisan project, obviously. You know, we're looking at an architecture that's been steadily constructed since the creation of the Bureau of Investigation, really. You had the Obama administration doing the whole sweep that they did against Occupy, for example, where they did all of this illegal intelligence work and then coordinate police activity nationally with local police departments to kick these people out.
Yep. Total confusion by the so-called left. Okay. Well, what's disarmed then? Oh, I wonder why they want you disarmed.
Right.
You've got repression going on overtly, targeting in that, and the so-called left response is to reinforce what it is they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I don't think they see the connection between trying to take away your gun and telling Iraq that you can't have a weapon to defend yourself or Korea or whatever. It's the same exact game with the same enemy.
Yeah, but meanwhile, you got the these militias out doing standoffs with assault weapons, real assault weapons in some cases. Yeah. Not what they're passing off as assault weapons, which are lookalikes, but semi-automatic rather than select fire. Okay, out in Utah, and they're taking a seizure of federal land in Oregon. Well, it's not federal land. It belongs to the Indians out there. But in any case, you know, that's the construction put on it, and they're walking away free.
Yeah.
And the FBI is not taking the lead in prosecuting it.
The idea of these agencies being politicized is stated in simple terms. More or less, that's how you've outlined it, that it's political, but not in the sense that people are concerned about whether it's a Republican or a Democrat or this person or that person in office, but rather that the institution survives and that their relationship to the levers of power remains or improves, right? Is that a fair statement?
I mean, this is an oxymoron. How do you politicize the political police? That's like criminalizing the Capone mob. I mean, they're political. It's a political entity. It performs political functions, but not in the arena that's all the dids are right now. This direction, big time.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.